ain't gonna change. Your time now, baby.
Always to John Lee Hooker and Carlos Santana for reminding us that the economy is changing and doing it in so beautiful a way. This is Economic Update. My name is Richard Wolff, and this is a program about what's happening in the economic parts of our lives. Our goal is to cover the most recent important events, but also to pick one or two key economic issues each week to examine in detail. The purpose of Economic Update now is to examine an economy in trouble and undergoing change. For that change to really benefit the majority of people, we need to know more than what is happening. We need to know how our economy could and should change in ways that would better serve our needs. Economic Update is a program that aims to do all that. I am your host, Richard Wolff. I've been a professor of economics all my life at several universities. Currently, I teach in the Graduate Program for International Affairs of the New School University in New York City. You can follow my economic analyses at rdwolff.com. I also want to thank Truthout, whose remarkable website is a courageous source of independent news and commentary daily. Check them out at truthout.org. We're interested in your questions and comments. Each week we select one or more and respond on the program. Just email your questions and comments to me again at rdwolff.com. Let us know if you would like us to use your name. And please bear with us. We get way more questions and comments than we have the time to answer. Please also become a fan of the show on Facebook and like our Economic Update page. By following us, you will receive updates about the show and posts of relevant articles, data, and information. You can post questions for me to answer on air there. I will do so or answer them on air. Let's turn then to the updates for today. The first one has to do with a little noted but important consequence of the current crisis. It begins by reminding us that it began, this crisis did, with a collapse of our housing market. We had millions of people who turned out to have taken out mortgages they didn't fully understand or that had been misrepresented to them by the lenders, the banks, and the mortgage brokers who got them into these mortgages in the first place. It's a sad story, but it has an extra bad quality. Many of the people drawn into the housing market for the very first time in the middle of the last decade were led to believe that they could finally become homeowners, could finally win the American dream of having your own home. And they were hustled in many cases by more or less unscrupulous mortgage hustlers who got them to take out mortgages that weren't very good, that charged too much, that would eventually cost way more than these people could afford. And so they were among those most badly hurt when they couldn't keep up the mortgages and they lost their homes. A recent story carried in the San Francisco Chronicle documented some of these details, and I wanted to share them with you today. By 2006, it was reported, the following percentages of people in America owned subprime loans. Those are loans that are called that because since the borrowers deemed to be not very well able to repay, they are required to accept very onerous conditions, pay higher interest rates, and so on. By 2006, then, listen to these numbers. 54% of African American mortgage holders had subprime loans. 47% of Hispanics and of whites, 18%. But here's the real important one. 61% of homeowners with subprime loans turned out to actually have been eligible for conventional loans with lower interest rates. Wow. That means these people were persuaded, I'm being polite, to take out loans disadvantageous to them, and they were in fact eligible for lower interest rate loans. And that's important not only for what it meant to those families, But it also means if their interest burdens had been lower, they might not have had to abandon their homes, stop paying their mortgages, and helping to produce a crisis from which they are the greatest victims. Here is what one person had to say about all of this. His name is Sean Donovan. He's the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, a member of President Obama's candidate. He said last year about one of the most infamous mortgage lenders, Countrywide Corporation. Here's what he had to say, and I quote, "Between 2005 and 2009, fully two-thirds of the median household wealth in Hispanic families was wiped out. From Jamaica, Queens, New York to Oakland, California, strong middle-class African-American neighborhoods saw nearly two decades of gains reversed in a matter of not years, but months." End of quotation. Wow. Most Americans don't have any real wealth. But for those Americans, maybe a third of the population, who have some wealth, the overwhelming majority of it is locked up in one kind of property, their home. When that is destroyed by unscrupulous, unethical, or illegal lending practices by banks, they suffer the most, and the rest of us suffer a good deal. The African American, Hispanic, and other minority communities have been particularly damaged by this crisis, and that is something we all ought to think about in terms of its implications and consequences. The second update I want to talk with you about today was a decision made a few weeks ago by the Japanese government. And it is a little bit like a decision made by the Argentinian government that I've also spoken to you about. Japan decided to nationalize, to take over, to have the government seize the largest utility company in the country, Tokyo Electric Power Company. Wow. The government is taking more than 50% of the voting rights by injecting, or in exchange, if you like, for injecting 1 trillion yen, that's roughly equivalent to $12 billion, into the company of public money, of the government's money raised from the people in the usual ways. Wow. Why is it doing that? Well, the reason it gave first was that the Tokyo Electric Power Company is the parent company of those nuclear power plants in Fukushima that were destroyed by the tsunami last year that we all know about. And the idea was it was becoming too costly for TEPCO, that's how the Tokyo Electric Power Company is known in Japan, it was becoming too costly for TEPCO to make all the repairs, to deal with all the nuclear dangers that are involved in that breakdown and that tsunami. But if you read the details closely, you discover that there's another reason. Electric power has become very expensive because of the shutdown, not just of the Fukushima damaged plants, but because the Japanese people became very worried about all their nuclear electric plants, whether they were safe, whether they could withstand storms and so on, that all, virtually all of the nuclear power plants in Japan, and there are many of them, have been shut down for detailed inspections and reconstructions to safeguard the Japanese people, and indeed the rest of the world, from what might happen there and came close to happening in Fukushima. So the cost of electricity is going up because all the other utilities, and there are many of them in Japan, are taking advantage of the shortages because Fukushima is closed down to rack up electricity prices, and that is harming Japanese businesses and consumers. So let's see. The damage done by nature, storm, tsunami, is actually being intensified by the actions of private enterprises, in this case in the private utility business, who are taking advantage of the market situation to jack up prices, which in turn conveys all kinds of new economic problems to all the other businesses and to all the customers of electricity across the country. Because the private enterprise system is being taken advantage of, because the market is being used by the electric companies, the government has been called in by all the other businesses in Japan and by the public to do something. So we have the government taking over a private enterprise, TEPCO, in order to use public money to subsidize electricity and bring the rates back down to where all the other capitalists and the public would prefer them to be. Please notice in this story that when governments take over private enterprises, the question that always has to be asked, why are they doing it, and in whose interest will they manage and run these enterprises? If they're doing it against the interests of private enterprise and for the interests of the mass of people, then it might be reasonable to use a word like socialist to describe government takeover. But if the purpose of the government takeover is to make private enterprises across the economy more profitable and to save money for consumers at the same time, then there's nothing about a government takeover that is in any way socialist or has anything to do with changing away from the capitalist system. It's simply a temporary act by a government to help capitalism as a system by taking over a company that the rest of the capitalists would prefer the government to run than to have it be run by one of themselves. And as the press reports of the government of Japan taking over TEPCO came out, it turns out that they're using as their model for how to do it the takeover by Japan in 2003 of the Resona Bank, R-E-S-O-N-A. And it turns out the government took over that bank, again using public taxpayer money, in order to prevent the rest of the banking system from falling under a cloud of suspicion that would risk the profits of all the other private banks. So when one bank, through its mismanagement of its private board of directors, came close to collapse, the rest of the banks called the government in to save themselves by having the government take over that bank. That's another example of governments taking over enterprises, but it has nothing remotely to do with socialism or with any agenda to move away from capitalism. The third economic update for today has to do with the auto industry. And here, what motivated me to choose this topic was a number of stories in recent weeks and months celebrating that the automobile industry has had a comeback over the last 6 months or so, has been selling more cars, and has been rehiring workers laid off in the earlier years, 2008, 2009, 2010, when the auto industry was in a severe crisis and when both Chrysler and General Motors had to be bailed out by the United States government. And the stories leave the impression that everything is hunky-dory, that the profits have returned, that the cars are being manufactured and sold, and the jobs are being recovered. Part of that story is true. Part of it is not. And that's what I want to make clear for everybody. Have the profits of these companies rebounded? Yes. But that's no mystery, since they were given huge subsidies in the tens of billions of dollars to General Motors, lesser amount for Chrysler. Huge subsidies that they were able to use to trim all kinds of costs and to become profitable again. So their profitability is unthinkable and would not have been possible without enormous help from the government. Is it true that they're selling more cars? Yes, that's also true. That's part of why they're making record profits. And finally, is it true that they're hiring back workers? Yes, that is also true. And that's certainly good news in those parts of the country where it's happening, although nowhere near as good news as the press lets on to believe. Let me explain. But before I do, let's look at the part of the story that's not true. Are workers being rehired? Yes. Are we getting back to the number of workers that had jobs in the auto industry before this crisis hit? Not at all. Let me just give you the raw numbers. In 2003, total employment in the automobile industry in the United States, 1.4 million Americans worked one place or another in the automobile industry. In 2008, the first year that the crisis really hit, it dropped to 1.2 million, down from 1.4. In 2011, the last year for which we have numbers, the total number of people, according to the Wall Street Journal of April 30th, 2012, I'm using that as my source so people have a clear idea where these numbers come from, we had 958,000 Americans working in the automobile industry. So from the high point of 2003 to the end of 2011, whatever else we can say about this crisis is we did bail them out. They have returned to profitability. They are selling more cars. They have hired more workers. But the total number of workers today is one-third less than it was in 2003. That's not a recovery. That's not a boom. That's a disaster for the people and the communities that depended on the automobile industry. In a mere 7 or 8 years, a loss of 33% of all the jobs. But now to what I want also to stress. And rather than tell you the story, I'm going to read you from the poetic article that appeared on page A12 of the Wall Street Journal, Monday, April 30th of this year. I'm now reading from that. Mitchell Wood, who had spent 20 years assembling vehicles and was earning $29 an hour at the time of the shutdown during the crisis, has found it tough to move on. Quote, "This job took me from being a low-level street hoodlum to having a family, going to church, contributing to my community," he said. After his layoff, Mr. Wood spent 2 years in community college training for a career in information technology. Over that time, he watched his life run in reverse. His wife left him. He lost his home in the suburbs, and he is back living in the same kind of tough neighborhood where he grew up. His retraining benefits ran out in December as he struggled to pass math classes. So he quit the school and applied for more than 100 jobs. He recently took an assembly line job at the Honda Motor Company plant in Marysville near Columbus, Ohio. It pays $13 an hour. Let me remind you, he was earning $29. Without benefits, through a temp agency. And he worried that his 1987 Plymouth wouldn't survive the 132-mile round-trip commute. One day into the job, he found something closer to home, a job cleaning streets and parks in Dayton, Ohio. There he earns $10.95 an hour with no benefits. "A lot of my family was disappointed," he said. "They'll say, 'Mitch, why are you doing this? You're better than that.' But hey, it's a job, and it pays the bills." The automobile industry, having lost 33% of the jobs, having converted countless people's, like this person I quoted, from a $29 an hour, secure, stable family life to a $10.95 an hour cleaning job in Dayton, Ohio. That is not a story of economic recovery. That is not a story of economic rebound. That is a story of a crisis that does not quit. Let me turn now to the first of two broader topics that I want to talk about today, because they're in the news. And indeed, this first one comes right from the story I just finished telling you about the Japanese Tokyo Electric Power Company. This has to do with privatization. When capitalist governments in capitalist countries undertake to take over a private enterprise, to literally convert from a private enterprise into a government enterprise. An awful lot of people have been led to believe that this is somehow, quote unquote, socialistic, that it has something to do with moving from a capitalist system to a different social system in which the government runs everything, in which planning by the government is the way goods and services are distributed rather than by market exchanges, and so on. And I want to stress the economic facts and reality that nothing of the sort is the case. In the majority of examples where governments have taken over enterprises, private enterprises, and converted them into government enterprises over the last 150 years, the intent has not been a transition from capitalism to socialism. Absolutely the opposite. The goal was to reinforce and strengthen private capitalism. And even in the cases, as I'll show, where the government took it over and talked about socialism, perhaps being led at the time by a socialist party or a communist party, what happened there was a long way from anything like what Karl Marx, for sure, thought socialism and communism meant. Let me explain. At various times in American history, I'm going to use the United States as the example most of the time here, American companies, for whatever reason, got worried that one or another of the companies around them would take advantage of them. The best example is what we call monopoly. If one company can become so big in a particular industry that it is the only seller of whatever that industry produces, then what it can do is jack up the price of whatever it makes way beyond what it could otherwise do because it's the only game in town. It's the only producer. So, for example, in many parts of the United States over our history, the railroad company was in that position. If you wanted to ship your grain that you produced on your farm, your corn, your wheat, your soybeans, whatever it was, and you wanted to ship them from where you grew it to the markets in the big cities, you had to move the produce over much of our history by train. There were no trucks for much of our history. The roads were not available, and when they became available, they were still often too expensive. Train was the way to go. But there was typically only one train company. So the government was called in by all the little farmers and all the big farmers who were afraid of being gouged by one private capitalist to prevent that capitalist from doing it. And there were two basic ways. One, you could break up the monopoly company and break it down into a bunch of competing company. We call that trust busting in American history, to break up the big companies into little. That happened a few decades ago when we had one national telephone company, the AT&T Corporation, and the government stepped in and broke them up into the separate companies we now know as Verizon or Southern Bell or Pacific Bell and so on. Sometimes, however, the government cannot, for a whole host of reasons, step in and control or break up a monopoly. And then the government is called in to take over the company. That's the story of the Tokyo Electric Power Company that I went through a few minutes earlier in this program. That's when the government steps in to help all the other capitalists by keeping the prices down. Now let me drive home the final message of this discussion of privatization. Often when the government is called in to take over something, and let me give you an example, the postal system. Here in the United States, we believe it's important that every company that has a bill to sell can get that bill into the hands of every person, no matter where he or she lives, in a little town off the beaten path. There will always be a way to get the bills to them, to get the correspondence with them that all business requires. And the way to do that has been, for most of our history as a nation, the public post office. If the government takes over, and why, by the way, was that done? Because private companies couldn't do it? Not at all. It was done because if private companies did it, they would then have a monopoly in whatever town or area they were located in. If they did all the distribution of letters and bills and advertising circulars and so on, there was a risk they would take advantage of that situation. Not only was there the risk that there might be a monopoly, but capitalists understood that if they got the government to take over the enterprise that produced something they all needed, they might get an extra benefit. They might get the government to set the price of whatever company they took over so low that, in effect, it would be a subsidy to all the commercial capitalist users. And that's exactly what the post office has been much of its life. The post office prices parcel post, first-class mail, overseas mail, bulk mail. It prices those things lower than what might be necessary if a private company did it. And many of you know that from comparing the prices, for example, of the post office to those charged by FedEx or any one UPS of the other private companies doing very similar kinds of work. So that government takeover can become a situation in which you low price your things so that government takeover is a subsidy of private capitalist enterprises across the economy. The furthest thing from a socialist alternative to capitalism, government takeover, when it lowballs the price, is in fact strengthening and reinforcing private capitalism. Think then how ludicrous it is when a conservative congressman or senator, he or she gets up and gives a speech about how sad it is that the post office is running at a loss or that Amtrak is not making the money. That's a mistake and not an innocent one. That's the whole point of the government running these enterprises. This is not a sign that the government doesn't know how to run a business. Government can run businesses just as well as anybody else can. This is a sign that the government-run business is doing what capitalists wanted to do, subsidize them. This is not an assault or a threat to capitalism. It is a subsidy and support to capitalism. Finally, why do I say that a government enterprise can do as good a job as a private? I could give you loads of examples where that's been the case, but I won't. Because you all know that there's also examples where the public doesn't do as good a job as the private. There are examples on both sides, which is why I say it's about the same. And let me explain why. Public enterprises have an advantage over private ones. And that advantage is, for a public enterprise, what it has to pay to get the goods or services produced in a public enterprise are the labor costs, the workers to be brought in to do the work, and to pay for all the tools, equipment, and raw materials that the workers have to work with and work on. A private enterprise has to pay for its workers, just like the public, and it has to buy tools, equipment, and raw materials, just like the public. But the private enterprise has to jack the price up to get something else that public enterprises don't have to. The private enterprise has to make a profit. It has to pay the labor costs, it has to pay all the materials costs, and it has to pay a profit to the shareholders who get dividends and to the board of directors who want to take home fat salaries. Public enterprises do not have to earn profits. Therefore, they can, not that they necessarily will, but they can produce at a lower price because the price doesn't have to include profits. So that's an important advantage that public enterprises have over private. That leaves open that corruption can happen in either one, mistakes can be made in either one, misjudgments can be made in either one. But in general, because of the basic advantage that public enterprises don't need to make profits, they often have in the past, and they can, produce the outputs we need at a lower price than the private alternative. Let's take our short mid-music break, and then I'll be back with more of Economic Update, This is Richard Wolff.
Say what she do? Snapping of a finger makes a dog wag its tail. A whistle from a voice make a train jump the rail. Take it to a racetrack, show a face. Horse that ain't won in years comes in first place. You know that she's into something.
Welcome back. This is Economic Update. I'm Richard Wolff, and we're now in the second half of today's program. The second larger topic I want to talk with you about today has to do with unemployment, a perennial topic on this program because it's a perennial problem of our economy. Let's briefly review. Back in 2007, the last year before the current crisis hit, we had roughly 7.5 million officially listed unemployed persons here in the United States. 7.5 million. As the crisis hit, starting late in 2007 and really gaining momentum in 2008 and 2009, we more than doubled that number to 15 million officially unemployed. Pretty close to 10% of the labor force in the United States. Over the last year and a half, very, very slowly, it has come down from 10% and is currently over 8%. Since the percentage was about 5% before the crisis hit, and it's over 8% now, that means the unemployment problem today is 60% worse than it was before this crisis hit. So if you ever hear someone tell you that we have an economic recovery in the United States, please remember this most basic number. 60% more unemployment today. May 2012, more, 60% more people unemployed than before this current crisis hit. And how many people is it? 12.5 million Americans today have no work, are looking actively for a job, have been doing so for a while, and can't find anything, and are earning, therefore, nothing. What does that mean, 12.5 people? Well, I don't have the time, and you don't need me to tell you what that means for those individuals. If they have any savings, they're running out of them. If they've had strains in their lives from disease, from problems in their relationships, whatever, those problems are made worse by being unemployed. If they thought well of themselves, their being unemployed, especially for many weeks, makes them think less well of themselves. All the indicators we have, mental illness, physical illness, emotional strains, breakup of relationships, boyfriends and girlfriends, husbands and wives, parents and children, all of those things go up with unemployment. The personal suffering, the educations that have to be postponed or interrupted, the medical care that is needed but has to be postponed because when we lose our job, we lose our medical insurance, and so on. All of those will have ramifications for those individuals, for their relatives, for their friends, for their neighbors, and for their communities for decades to come. The cost of millions of unemployed people is incalculable. And if even economics doesn't persuade you, then sheer human decency, ethics, and morality ought to make this a concern for every responsible American citizen. But as I say, this is a program in economics, and I'm going to have to focus on that. If we add to the people looking for work and unable to find it, the people who have in recent months given up looking, we're talking about several million more. And if finally we add the people who have part-time jobs but are looking for full-time jobs, which they would prefer, we're talking not only of the 12.5 million unemployed, but we've got to throw another 10 million on top of it to take account of what we now call discouraged or marginalized workers, those no longer looking, and the involuntarily part-timers in our economy. Wow. Upwards of 20 and above that, millions of people either not working or not working anywhere near as much as they need and want to work. If you have that clearly in your mind, a second reality. The government keeps track of how much of our productive capacity is being used. And here's what they mean. How much of the square footage of a store, of a mall, of a factory, of an office is sitting idle, empty, not being used? What portion of the machines and equipment and tools are sitting idle, gathering rust and dust? What portion of the factory is dark because we don't need to bring electricity into it because nothing's happening there? Currently, May 2012, the official government capacity utilization rate is around between 65 and 70%. So let's be conservative. Roughly a third of the productive capacity of the United States right now is not being used. So let's put the two together. We have 20 or more million people who want to work, who want to use their brains, their muscles, their training, their education to be productive citizens. And we have more than enough tools, equipment, factory, office, store space for them to work in, to work with, and to work on. If we put together the people who want to work who are now unemployed with the unused capacity to produce that we already have, the output of the United States would be much larger than it is. It is the most profound failure of capitalism that I can think of, that it is a system systematically unable, incapable of putting together the people who need and want to work with the equipment and tools and factory and office space that's already been built and available to produce extra output. And what could the output be used for? Rebuild our cities, create a daycare system that would be the envy of the world to free up younger parents to go to work, which they want to do, while still being confident that their children are properly cared for, to do something for the increasingly elderly population, to rebuild the infrastructure of the United States that needs work, and so on. I did a little calculation, because that's what we economists do, and I asked myself, let's assume 8% of the American people are unemployed in our labor force, which is what the government says. It's actually more than 8, but I'm going to use a round number, 8%. So I said to myself, if 8% more people were working with all the available unused capacity, how much extra output would we get in the United States? And to make sure everyone understands, I'll tell you my calculation. I assumed if you put 8% more people to work in the unused capacity, you get roughly 8% more output. Well, what is our output these days as a nation? It's about $15 trillion. Our GDP, our gross domestic product, is $15 trillion. So if we put 8% more people to work, just put the unemployed to work, not all the part-timers, leave them alone, suffering, not the discouraged and marginalized, just the fully unemployed, 8%. We put them all to work, it would produce an additional $1.2 trillion of output. So I asked myself, simplest idea, suppose we divided the extra output, $1.2 trillion, among all Americans equally. Everybody got an equal check for the value of that extra output. Every American would get $3,750 for this year. Every family of four would get $15,000 more than it has now. And how could we get such a stunning benefit? Simply by using the tools and equipment that are already there. And simply by giving work to the people who complain that they aren't being given a job. A system that cannot deliver to its people the fruits of the full employment of people who want to work when all the equipment and tools and raw materials are available for them, that's an economic system where it is past due to raise the most fundamental questions and to debate this simple question. Can we do better than a capitalism that works in this way? That debate should have existed in this country for the last 50 years. Current conditions make it a scandal that it isn't in the foreground of public discussion and debate now. And in the face of this, to hear people say how efficient capitalism is as a system suggests a level of blindness that is genuinely scary. In the time remaining in today's program, I turn, as I always do, to the questions and comments you have sent in. And today, I've picked two of them, and I want to lay out what was said to me and to give you my response. The first is a question that came from a person who found it quite interesting that I was talking about enterprises that wouldn't be run in the conventional capitalist way. That's with a group of shareholders. We call them the major shareholders. All corporations have that, a relatively small group of people, 10 or 20, who own directly or indirectly the bulk of the shares of that company. So they have the votes. Since everything in a company is decided one vote per share, if you own a lot of shares, you get a lot of votes. If you own one share, you get one vote. So the major shareholders are the ones in most corporations who call the shots. And one of the things the major shareholders can and regularly do is to select the board of directors. The people at the top of every corporation are elected by the shareholders. And in practice, that means the 10 to 15 people that comprise most boards of directors of corporations are selected by the 10 to 15 people who are the major shareholders. Tiny group of people sitting at the top of corporations. And when I've talked about an alternative to that, the one I've stressed the most is a enterprise which we call workers' self-directed enterprises, where the workers become their own board of directors. Monday through Thursday, they work on the particular task they have in the factory, in the office, in the store. But on Friday, when they come to work, they spend many hours not doing their particular task that day, but instead doing what a board of directors does, deciding through much open discussion and debate and being advised by technical experts what to produce, how to produce, where to produce, and what to do with the profits that the enterprise earns. And this questioner took issue with me, and he said that it would be crazy, his word, for workers to be forced to enter into immense long meetings, making all of the thousands of decisions that are made in a corporation each day. The idea of this questioner was that workers are happy or satisfied or prefer to have a particular job that they focus on, and when the end of the day comes, they lay their tools down and they go home. They don't want to worry about, let alone be embroiled in, making complicated decisions on literally thousands of issues. Here's my response. On one level, this question's a little silly, with all due respect. Boards of directors don't make thousands of little decisions. They delegate all kinds of managerial authority, and they actually delegate all kinds of authority to the workers to make all kinds of daily and important decisions. What boards of directors do, and therefore what I have in mind when I talk about workers becoming their own board of directors, is that the workers will do what the boards now do. That is, they will provide general oversight on the basic directions and the most important decisions of the corporation, and they will reserve to themselves those key questions. What do we stop producing, and what new kinds of things do we start producing? How do we produce? In other words, what's our basic technology? Will we use oil or gas? And then where we produce? Will we operate outside the United States, inside the United States, and so on? And finally, to decide what to do with the profits. Will we invest in expansion? Will we provide a daycare center for our workers? Will we improve our relationships with young people coming into the labor force? All those kinds of questions. Those are not the thousands of little questions. And that's not what workers would do if they took over their own directors' positions. When workers take over their own enterprises, become their own boards of directors, they will make that limited, general, overview kind of decision that boards of directors make in operating corporations now. No more, and really no less. Let me take a step back and say one further thing about this. Whenever I go around the country speaking about worker self-directed enterprises and talking to Americans about how there's been a long tradition in the United States of people being interested in this, sometimes calling it worker-owned enterprises, ESOPs, employee stock ownership plans, or more generally calling these things co-ops or cooperatives. There's a long history of workers looking to run their own businesses rather than being told what to do by other people who make all the decisions. But I recognize, as this questioner does, that these are big questions. These are big changes we're talking about here. And we would have to be ready as a nation to want them. We would have to want, as working people, not just to be drones, not just to be told what to do, but to have a real participation in deciding what happens at our workplaces. We have to have that, let's call it a democratic appetite, a notion that to be fully human, you have to, in that place where you spend most of your adult life, the workplace, 5 days a week, prime time of the day, that's where you are. That's where you devote your brains and your muscles to being useful in the community. Major part of that. If you care about democracy, if you want to be a person who has some say about the whole design of the job, the whole use of the job, the place of the job in the larger society, rather than just being a drone, comes to work, do the job, go home, then we will see the kind of movement to change the way we organize our workplaces that I'm talking about. So I'm aware that we would have to have a different culture. We would have to have a different school system to sustain that kind of a system that I've been talking about. Just as today's culture and today's school system serves an economic organization in which the mass of people have no say, are trained and disciplined from elementary school forward to accept what goes on in a factory as though it were necessary, as though their having no power is ordained by the very nature of technology. We would have to give all that up. We would have to change to an economic system, but also a cultural system, a school system that developed in people the capacity to participate democratically, developed in them the appetite to be a designer and not just a worker, a boss and not just an underling, to play both roles in a full life rather than to be consigned only to one. So I'm aware that this is a big change, but I don't think we have to be slowed down or distracted by worrying that we'll do an immense array of thousands of small decisions. Boards of directors don't do that now, and if and when workers become their own board of directors, they won't have to do that either. Final question for today. Questioner writes, is the housing market in the United States that took the whole economy down with it, is it finally bottoming out, as people say? Is it turning around? Is the news from the housing market really the basis for seeing a recovery. And I'm afraid, folks, even though I know I would rather give you and you would rather hear an enthusiastic yes to this question, that I leave you to your other radio programs and your nightly news on television to get the cheerleading. That's not my function. So let me give you the information as it has been publicly carried by the Census Bureau, the National Association of Realtors, and a very useful website group called CoreLogic. Here's the basic problem. Privately owned housing fell from 2005 to 2009. Since that time, across 2009, 10, 11, and into 12, it's basically staying at the low level it reached. It's not continuing to fall, and a lot of people see that as positive. But a rebound, a recovery, not at all. What about sales of previously owned homes as opposed to constructing new ones? Well, the story is pretty much the same. And when it comes to the prices of homes, I'm afraid the news is worse. Home prices are continuing to fall. It's true they're not falling as much as they did in 2008, 2009, and 2010, but they are still falling. As of February 2012, home prices fell 2% from the same month a year earlier. One of the key problems, and that's why I want to end with you today, one of the key problems of our housing industry is what is called the shadow inventory. What does that mean? It's all the houses currently owned by banks who took them over when the people in the home could no longer make their mortgage payments. When that happens, the bank can go into court and initiate something called a foreclosure procedure, which is a legal mechanism to throw you out of your home. The bank then takes the home back from you because you've been unable to make your payments. Now here, let's look. At the end of March 2012, banks owned about 450,000 properties. Whoa. Half a million homes owned by banks who don't own them to live in them or to let anybody else live in them most of the time. Their only interest is sell them. And if they're constantly trying to sell them, then there's no mystery as to why the prices of homes keep going down because you've got banks unloading them. But the story is worse. At the end of March, in addition to the 450,000 homes that banks owned, foreclosed homes, there were an additional 2 million loans in some stage of foreclosure. And on top of that, 1.7 million more homes where mortgage payments hadn't been made in more than 90 days. Normally, you have to make a mortgage payment every month. With that kind of a backlog, wow, we're not going to see any kind of recovery in the housing market for years unless we dramatically change the capacity of the millions of people in homes today to be able to resume making their mortgage payments. And the only way to do that is to increase the number of people having a job, that's overcoming unemployment, and raising, not lowering, the wages people get. Neither of those things is happening. And therefore, we cannot expect the market in housing to improve in a significant way, so it cannot help bring the recovery that has eluded us. Bottom line, the market in housing has not recovered, and indeed promises to be like an anchor preventing the economy from rising for years into the future from today. Thank you so much for being with me. This is Economic Update. Richard Wolff, I look forward to talking with you again soon. Ain't gonna change.
Sometime in the middle of the night, I get so lonely, so lonely, so lonely. Things ain't gonna change, things ain't gonna change. Change, change, change. Ain't gonna change. for the own up the road, baby. Thing gonna change. Change, change, change. Change, change. Change, baby. Your time now, baby. But after a while, gonna be my time, babe. Thing gonna change. Change, change, change. Change, change, change. Thing gonna change.